Well, welcome everybody to after-dinner intellectual dessert. My name is Ted Peters, if you haven't met me yet, and I teach systematic theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley. And our topic for the week is, are we playing God with our genes? And I have a slogan, it's good for at least tonight. It's actually not a slogan, it's a Bible passage. It's in 1 John 4, and if you read your Bibles very carefully, you'll find it. God loves each of us regardless of our genetic makeup, and we should do likewise. That's the theme of the book, For the Love of Children, and some of the topics that we'll be talking about tonight are things that I researched in working on that particular book. But we're going to start with just a quick introduction to gene hunting, and focus primarily, at least for the first two-thirds of our discussion, on hunting for genes that predispose us to diseases, and then take a look at some of the unexpected ramifications, social and economic and ethical ramifications of what's going on. ABCs of genetics. Suppose I have in my fingers here a white thread, and this white thread is draping down near the floor. In fact, if you take a chromosome, piece of DNA, and you dry it, looks like a piece of white thread, and some of them are just about that long. So it could be more than just a metaphor here, but it's not actually a thread, it's a chain. It's a chain of nucleotides, and those of you who were here yesterday, you saw that they've got letters, A, C, G, and T, and sometimes they're nicknamed the alphabet of DNA, and what DNA is a chain of these letters. And so you can use the metaphor, the task of the geneticist is to read the code, find out what order those letters are in. That's learning, that's what you call sequencing. We want to know the sequence of the letters in human DNA, and we expect there to be 3 billion of them. So you're not going to have a file cabinet big enough to hold this information. Where are you going to go to get it? We're going to have to go to computers. And where's a good place for computers? Well, the weapons industry is gearing down, and that leaves all those computers at Los Alamos available, and so a lot of the genetic knowledge is being stored in the computers at Los Alamos in New Mexico. Hence, the Department of Energy is one of the major government agencies sponsoring the Human Genome Project, along with the National Institutes of Health. An enormous amount of information. But now let's get back to this white thread. And so we've got all of these, this alphabet now of nucleotides. And let's go down a couple of inches, and we'll find a segment on there of maybe 3 inches long. That segment there on the white thread expresses itself. It codes for a protein. It does something. And that area on the thread of DNA, or the chain of nucleotides, is what you call a gene. So then we might go another 6 inches, nothing happens, and then maybe the next 2 inches, they code for a protein, there's another gene. And then maybe you go down another 4 inches, etc. The DNA in between the genes is affectionately called junk DNA. Now, someday they may find out what it does, but currently it just kind of lays there and separates the genes. So the second thing that the Human Genome Project does, remember the first one is to sequence all those nucleotides, find the alphabet. The second one is to locate the genes and find out what they do. The third task is to look specifically for genes that predispose us to diseases, expecting that there are 4,000 to 6,000 human diseases for which you can go right back and find the genetic cause. And the gene hunters are those people that are going after those disease genes, amongst all the other kinds of things that are going on in the Human Genome Project. And since, over the last few years, it's been amazing success at this. Those of you here yesterday, we saw Nancy Wexler, remember, down in Venezuela with that large family that had Huntington's disease. And she herself knows that the gene is in her family. And remember, she said, we found a marker right up on the top of chromosome 4. Well, since that film was made, they actually found the gene. They now have that one. I mentioned cystic fibrosis was found on chromosome 7 in 1992. They've got two genes, they think, for Alzheimer's disease, one on 14, one on 21. That's going to be multifactorial, more research to be done there. Colon cancer on chromosome 2, on down the line. The information is coming in. Could you turn on that Kodak carousel projector? Nope, just leave that alone, please. Yes, Dwayne, if you just push the rear button all the way forward. Thank you. And if someone would turn off the lights over there. I'll show pictures while I talk. The word genome, if you don't know, just refers to the total number of genes. Each one of us in the room has our own personal genome. That's the total number of genes that we have, roughly 100,000. The whole human race is going to have more than what you and I have individually. After all, we have to account for the slight differences between us as individuals. And so the Human Genome Project is going to have to go around and find every gene, and if they test you or they test me, they'll get most of them, but not all of them. So there's a kind of whole human genome, that is to say, every gene that is on the face of the earth in a human being, and then you're in my individual genomes. The magazine Science, every September, publishes where we are in the state of research. Scientists all over the world communicate with each other almost daily with fax and email on computers. One of the amazing untold stories that's going on right now is the way in which scientific research is being shared. The United States isn't the only country in this. Japan, Russia before the fall of the Berlin Wall, Western Europe, all of these countries have genome research projects of some kind or another, and the scientists share this information constantly about what's going on. And so every fall, they publish where we are. And last fall, it looked as though we'd found 16,000 genes and had at least some markers throughout the entire human genome. So most everyone says the Genome Project is on target. It is expected to finish somewhere around the year 2003 with all of this information gathering. So 16,000 out of 100,000, that's not bad. This is Mary Claire King, and Mary Claire King was a consultant to our research project in Berkeley, and she's what you call a gene hunter. And she has given her professional career to finding the gene for inherited breast cancer. And while we were working on our project, it had not yet been found, and in her laboratory, this was where the work was being done. Although she wasn't the only one, there were researchers all over this country and in other parts of the world going after the same gene. They had narrowed it down to chromosome 17, knew it was there. She had about 130 families in which inherited breast cancer was running, and she'd go out and interview the people, and she'd take blood samples and collect it so that through analysis and deduction, they would get closer and closer to the gene for inherited breast cancer. It's long, laborious work. She had hot and cold running graduate students who were helping her. I say past tense now because she packed up, this is her laboratory in Berkeley, which was just a two wood and a chip shot from our office. And she now moved to a place called University of Washington. Nobody's ever heard of that. Took her whole laboratory with her. At any rate, so this was about 2 years ago. And what you see on this board here is a map that she was working on for chromosome 17. Well, there it is, right there. The gene for inherited breast cancer is a direct cause for breast cancer in 0.5% of women who get breast cancer. You might say, oh, that's a small amount. It's 185,000 new cases a year in this country. That's not small in an absolute number. And Mary Claire is convinced that if we could find out what inherited breast cancer does, we might be able to learn something about breast cancer in general that will be therapeutic in character. All breast cancer has a genetic component. It's just an inherited breast cancer. It's bang from gene to the symptoms. I visited her shortly before it was found, and she was pointing out this area here on chromosome 17 where the word vat is, see? So you got some junk DNA, then you got VAT, and she says, you know what this is? She says, this is a gene that we share with the electric eel. I don't know if you know that, but DNA is DNA, whether it's in human beings or in other animals. And I said, well, Mary Claire, what does that gene do? She says, I don't know. She says, I don't have time to find out. I'm going after the breast cancer gene. And I said, well, I hope it's the one that causes the spark when you walk across a carpet and shake hands. Well, the breast cancer gene was finally found, but not by Mary Claire. As I said before, scientists are always sharing their information about this. The actual team that came up with it was in Utah. And they felt proud that they had found the breast cancer gene, but they felt a little guilty because they knew that she had invested 10 years of research focused on this, so they let her name it. So she named it BRCA1, and you would say, oh, it's obvious that that stands for breast cancer. I said, Mary Claire, BRCA can also stand for Berkeley, California, right? She says, yes, it can. So that's BRCA1, and within about 6 or 8 months, they found a second gene for breast cancer. I think it was on chromosome 11. So now two of them are known. And basically what goes on here, we discussed yesterday, the concept of a defective gene, and that's what you've got here, is you've got the normal pattern of DNA is disrupted. That in the breast cancer gene, you've got a large chunk that is simply missing. And in more severe cases, there's a larger piece missing, and in the milder cases, there's a small amount missing. Well, does that end the research then? Should she pack her suitcases and go home and say it's over? The treasure's been found? By no means. Because this is just step one in the task. Knowing that there's a genetic predisposition to inherited breast cancer is nice for the scientists, but it doesn't help a single woman. Mary Claire is dedicated to finding the switch that turns it on and turns it off. Her thought is maybe in the DNA just adjacent to that genetic area, maybe there is a switch that turns it on and turns it off, and could she come up with a pharmaceutical that would keep it turned off? Or perhaps some other form of genetic therapy. Maybe a somatic therapy wherein you'd send a properly functioning gene right into the old cell that would simply take the place of this one that is malfunctioning. So her work is going to go on until a therapy has been developed. But at minimum, the advantage of this kind of research is that women could, in the future, once a test has been developed, and there's a race now to develop that test, once you can have a test to find out whether you have it or not, if you're a woman, you would go and you would get tested, and if you have this particular genetic configuration, then you would know to be monitored scrupulously and carefully so that if there's a symptom of cancer, then it could be dealt with quickly. These are some more pictures of our research team in Berkeley. Philip Hefner, some of you are Lutherans, will know him from Chicago. Roger Shin on the left, ethicist at Union Seminary in New York, and Karen LeBox with me at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Both were instrumental in writing statements on genetics by the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches back in the mid-1980s. Now let's take a look at some issues, some ramifications. I mean, one could say, this science is just wonderful. Look at the ways in which it's going to make human life better. Ah, yes. But we got some problems coming down the pike. The reason I have President Reagan and Nancy shown here is that President Reagan, after he left the White House, was said to have symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Of course, the humor when he was in the White House seemed to indicate the same thing, but it was officially announced later. Is Alzheimer's genetic? You bet. And there are a lot of people searching for just what is the role that genes play in Alzheimer's disease. And as I said before, a lot of progress has been made in terms of identifying the genetic predisposition. Why does it happen late in life rather than early in life? All these are interesting questions. From a business point of view, if you want to know where to invest your money, where you're going to get a return, invest your money in the company that is going to discover the cure for Alzheimer's disease. There's a large number of cases, and there's going to be an extremely high demand. I've gone to the business side of the genetic industry, and that's where the money is currently flowing. And I'll talk about other issues later about, because there are so many people, I'll talk about it right now. Because there are so many cases of Alzheimer's disease, that they're predicting that as soon as the pharmaceutical for Alzheimer's comes out in the market, that the company that gets it is going to have a profit in the category of $2 billion a year as soon as they start. So, because there are so many cases. What about Williams syndrome? I write about Williams syndrome in the book For the Love of Children. Because a couple that are close to my family have a child with Williams syndrome, which is due to a defect in chromosome 7. They know right where it is. There's no cure for it. You just know where the genetic defect is. It's chromosome 7. But there are only 25,000 cases a year. Well, where are you going to get the private money to invest in research on Williams syndrome? The money's going to go where the profit is going to be, and that's where the numbers are. And so to me, this is an ethical issue. If our society thought of itself as an egalitarian society, how is it that we can be sure that we're not discriminated against in the way that research money is allocated? But that's a complicated issue, and I didn't plan on getting into that, and I got into it anyway. Okay. Would the knowledge that you have the genetic predisposition to Alzheimer's disease be of some advantage? What about other diseases? Great news, Mr. Jones. We found in your DNA that you will likely have stomach cancer at age 52, colon cancer at 50, 67, and if you're still alive, prostate cancer at 65. Can we do prenatal tests to find out eventually all the diseases that we might be predisposed toward? Well, coming down the pike is the issue of genetic discrimination due to the connection between employment and healthcare and the knowledge of genetics. And I suggested this scenario yesterday, and I want to spell it out a little bit more. Let's just imagine 10 years from now that we have discovered every gene in the human genome, and that you can have a test that will identify every gene that you have, and we'll code it, and we'll put it on a little card like a Visa card. Your entire genome will be put on a Visa card in your wallet. You move to a new town, and you get a new physician. You go visit the physician. The doctor says, please give me your genome. You hand the doctor the card. The doctor puts it in the computer, and your entire genetic code is there, and now you're ready for a program of preventative health care. Wouldn't that be just wonderful? The problem is that your employer will also want to see that card for the employer's computer, because the employer's computer is linked to the healthcare provider's computer. And your insurance coverage is paid for by your employer, but the insurance company may not want to pay for the genes that you have. So suppose you have a gene for Alzheimer's disease, and this company knows that you're going to get it. Will they want to take you on? Or if you got a genetic predisposition to inherited breast cancer, or to colon cancer, or to what have you, and they think that you're going to be an expensive client, well, couldn't we just take clients for our insurance company that have better genomes rather than worse? And of course, employers are going to want to also have the lowest insurance premiums that they have to pay. And so you just see the kind of pressure now that is going to be placed on people who have bad genes. Anecdotally, the fires are already burning. Paul Billings, who was also a consultant to our project, is a medical doctor and a genetic ethicist, and he's gone around to interview people who have already had trouble, insurance trouble. And there was a couple in Louisiana that she was pregnant. And they knew that mom and dad were both carriers of the cystic fibrosis gene. As I mentioned, that gene was discovered in 1992. You can test for it now. You can find out whether you've got that gene. Mom and dad are carriers. That means they each have one copy of the gene. They don't have the disease, but they have the potential of passing it on to their children. She's pregnant. They ask that the baby-to-be be tested prenatally, and they discover that the fetus has one copy of the CF gene. That means this child will never get the disease, but could pass the disease on to the next generation. The HMO to which they belong demanded that they have an abortion. And if they wouldn't have an abortion, they would be dropped from the plan. Well, the couple did not want to have an abortion. They filed suit, and they were able to retain their medical care plan and bring the child to birth. But one can anticipate now how financial pressures are going to utilize the advance in genomic knowledge and try to reorganize around this knowledge how it is that healthcare will be paid for. A couple of years ago, as you probably remember, Bill and Hillary Clinton were trying to get some form of a national health care program underway. And our project anticipated that. We got a real expert in this field named David Peters to write us a research paper on the relationship between insurance and ethics and this kind of an issue. By the way, I did send it to the White House. We never got a reply. on this issue, at the same time, ELSI, that's the Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications Division, it's a working group actually between the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Energy, did a study on this problem, and they had representatives of the insurance industry involved in the study. And the representatives of the insurance industry said, you know, we don't want to make life miserable for people. That's not why we're in business. But we really want legislation that will make sure that there's an even playing field between the various companies. So it's going to be easy, as the controversy rages here, to vilify the insurance industry. And the insurance industry is only going to ask for an even playing field. Without an even playing field, they're going to go for the largest profit. And the largest profit is going to discriminate against people with bad genes. So this report was placed on the president's desk about the time the president's program went poof. And as far as I know, has simply become a dead letter. There have been some attempts at legislation, but the legislation has been, in my judgment, wrongheaded. And here's why. The most accepted view is that what we want is genetic privacy. And if those of you who are here yesterday remember, James Watson was talking about privacy. I don't use the word. I use the word discrimination, because discrimination is the problem and privacy is one of the solutions. The privacy people argue that the way we can prevent genetic discrimination is by making each one of us the owner of our own genomic information. It's our own private property. So nobody can have our genomic information except those whom we want to share it with. And of course we're going to want to share it with our doctor, right? That's the way to cure the problem of genetic discrimination. I say that's wrongheaded for two reasons. First, it won't work, and secondly, it's not even desirable. It won't work because genomic information is peculiarly and almost exhaustively computer information. Everybody who has this information is going to have it on a computer, and in our day and age, computers are linked all over the place. If somebody wants to know your genome, they're going to find out. It's not going to be that hard to get that information. Secondly, I don't think we want it. We want to hide our genomic information, because the real value of genomic information is preventative health care. That's where it's going to be. We had a situation like that in our own family of sorts. My wife Jenny and I have a godson named Matthew. And Matthew was adopted by Dean and Brenda, the parents, some years ago. We stood up for the baptism. Matthew grew up as a happy young man in this family, and I think he was somewhere around 18 years old, rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery having to do with colon cancer. He had a case of familial intestinal polyptosis. Okay. Well, there was a kind of a heroic long surgery. And the doctor came out exhausted, and he flops down by Dean and Brenda, and he says, well, I think we've got it all. I think things are going to be okay. It was tough, but we did. And he said, you know, I just read in a British medical journal where this kind of cancer is genetic. Now, does Matthew have any other cases of this in his family? They said, well, we don't know. He was adopted, and there was no information about his family. The doctor said, well, you know, if we'd have known that it was in his family, if we'd have known that he had a genetic propensity for it, around the ages 10 or 11, we would have been monitoring him very, very closely. He never would have gotten to this emergency situation. Well, you can see how genetic knowledge could contribute if it's shared rightly, it could contribute to preventative health care. So it seems to me you don't want to so structure things that you're always trying to keep genetic knowledge private. I think what we want is some kind of policy that we have genetic information without discrimination. I don't know how that's going to look. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how to write the legislation, but we really want genetic information out there, but without the penalty of discrimination. Well, now let me move on to a related issue here, abortion. And I think that some aspects of the abortion controversy are going to change due to the advancement of genetic knowledge. Two ways. First has to do with early embryos. There's a situation in England, again, right after the discovery of the cystic fibrosis gene, where a laboratory took an egg from a mother and a sperm from a father, actually a number of them, both of whom were carriers of the cystic fibrosis gene, and what they wanted would be a child who would not have the disease. So they fertilized 10 eggs with 10 sperm in petri dishes. Then they watched the cells divide until they had 8 cells in each one of them, and they pulled one of those cells out. If you can do that in an embryo, you don't harm the cell. You got 7 left, and that will replicate naturally. And then they took that one apart to see whether or not the CF gene was in there. Well, they found 2 of the 10 with no CF gene. The others either had 1 or 2 copies. So they took those 2 and they planted them in the mother. One of them took and she gave birth to a child who will not get the disease cystic fibrosis and will not even pass on the possibility of it to future generations. What an achievement. And how can anyone say, gee, science isn't really helping in this kind of situation? The question is, well, what did you do with the other 8 embryos? Well, you threw them away. You discarded them. Well, what's the moral status of those fertilized concepti? And if you're Roman Catholic, it's clear those were abortions. And any definition of abortion that requires that it be the termination of a pregnancy in a woman's body isn't going to fly with the Vatican. Those are abortions because when the sperm fertilizes the egg, God imparts a soul, and this is a contract between mommy, daddy, and the divine. And so to just throw those 8 away because they had the wrong genetic formula, that's going to get the Pope ticked off. Now, even if you're not the Pope, even if you're pro-choice on the abortion issue, you still have to ask, isn't there some moral dignity? It's a fair question. I don't know exactly what the answer is, but it is a reasonable question that needs to be asked and needs to be sorted out. I spend some time in my book, For the Love of Children, discussing the primitive streak theory, which those of you that heard the other Dr. Peters last night discussing RU486, there may be, in that understanding of the first 14 days of the pre-embryo, some room for maneuvering here on a number of ethical issues, but we're just, as a society, going to have to sort that one out in the next few years. So that's one way in which the advance of genetic knowledge is going to push us to recast some of the issues with regard to abortion. The second has to do with selective abortion. By the way, this is just a picture of my daughter here. This is an excuse so that you see what my daughter looks like. And the baby was borrowed just for this slide. The selective abortion issue will go like this. So now we can test a prenatally a fetus to find out whether it has a cystic fibrosis gene. And pretty soon what my godson Matthew had, and for Huntington's disease, and on down. Maybe we're going to get 100 tests. Maybe we'll get 200. Maybe we'll get 300. After all, we're going after 5,000 diseases. Can you imagine a time in the not very distant future when every time a woman gets pregnant, that pregnancy will be very tentative? Because you won't know whether you're going to keep the child or not until the tests are run. Find out which genes the baby has, and then whether or not you can tolerate these genes. Some of these genes are going to be worse than others. Where do you draw the line between those genes which are acceptable or not? If your baby girl is going to have the gene for an inherited breast cancer, and if she's not going to contract it until she's in her 60s, most likely, is 60 years of cancer-free life, does that pass the test or not? Or do you want to bring her into the world in hopes that maybe by the time she's 60, Mary Claire will have found the cure, and then she can live the rest of her life? What about a disease that has an earlier onset? What are the criteria by which a fetus gets to live or die? And how many tests are going to be? I don't know where we are on this, or where we're going to be, but it seems to me that the ethicists are going to earn an honest living in the next few years if they can help us come to some thought process whereby we can work our way through it. Now, this is not just a luxury for philosophical ethicists. There's going to be economic pressure of significance. This is an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, and note what the author of this article is trying to inform us about. Some babies are more expensive than others because once they're born, they have health care issues which cause somebody over the child's lifetime to pay a lot more money. Look at the genetic problems here. Spinal bifida, Down syndrome. Okay, so suppose you test your child, and right now we can do this with Down syndrome, right? Three copies of chromosome 21. 8 out of 10 people who test their fetus and find out that there are three copies of chromosome 21 aboard. So the population of Mongoloids in our society is going down. Now look what's being said here. Oh, well, suppose you decide, our child is going to have Down syndrome, we're going to bring that child into the world, but it's going to cost $410,000 more to raise that child than a normal child. Who's going to pay for it? The insurance company? Well, what if the insurance company says we won't insure babies being born with Down syndrome? Well, then maybe the U.S. government. Well, what about all the taxpayers in the neighborhood who say, I don't want to pay for your kid with Down syndrome, the extra 400. Maybe you should pay for it. Well, even if you're an advocate of free choice on abortion, when you see financial pressure like this, it doesn't look free anymore. So in some ways, the alignments on who's for and against abortion according to what criteria, there might be some shifting coming down the pike. There's a larger philosophical issue at stake here. I think where we're going to run into this, of course, is families confronted with the dilemma of how to pay for the children that they already know are going to have expensive genes. That's where we're going to run into it. But the larger philosophical issue has to do with eugenics. I'm going to write that up here on the board in case you don't know that word. Eugenics is a philosophical point of view that says we can genetically improve the quality of the human race by selecting better genes for future generations. And the eugenics movement began with the cousin of Charles Darwin, a guy by the name of Galton, about 100 years ago, started in England, Germany, and in America. And in those days, they didn't have high tech, so they just planned on selective breeding. They learned how to do selective breeding with animals. And so now the eugenics movement wanted to do it with human beings. And most of us are too young to remember state fairs in the time of the First World War, but state fairs had big eugenics booths that you'd go to, and they'd help you choose mates to get married so that you could raise intelligent children, children with physical prowess, etc. That was the eugenics movement. In Germany, the eugenics movement got connected with anti-Semitism and produced under the Nazis the program of racial hygiene. And the SS was in charge of it. And the invention of the ovens for extermination was the first, that was invented by the SS for the purpose of eugenics, to eliminate genetic defects, physically handicapped and mentally handicapped. And once that was successful, they expanded it then in the other concentration camps for political dissidents and for Jews. And so eugenics is remembered in Europe rather acutely today. And in Europe, especially in Germany, these kinds of issues are really hot. Really hot. In America, they're kind of cool, but they're going to heat up in America too, I think, over the next half decade. Now, are we going to have a eugenics movement in the United States like Nazi Germany? No, I don't think so, because in Nazi Germany, you had a totalitarian government that was superimposing an ideology from the top down. We're not going to have that in this country, but I think what we're going to have is free market eugenics. We're going to have a eugenics that will be driven by who it is that's paying for health care. And so there won't be an articulated ideology as much as there will be just financial pressures that will be guiding that. Now, I don't know if that's good or bad, but it is a way of talking about the future of the human race in which things are out of control. At least philosophically and morally, they're out of control because they'll be driven by economic pressures that owe allegiance to nobody. This is actually from the Lutheran magazine, believe it or not, for the pre-born Acme gene tester. Fail and pass. I think the role of the Vatican here has yet to be made clear, but I think, by the way, I can't see my watch very well. I don't want to go over. What time is it now?
7:01.
Okay, we're in good shape because we want to be out of here by about 7:25, I think. The Pope has come out as the champion of human dignity. Now, there's a little quirk in Western history because when you go back to the 18th century and the 17th century, and you've got the revolutions that took place in which secular society tried to divest itself of church authority. One of the things we wanted in the secular world was human dignity over against our religious roots that we thought were denied. Now, in the last decades of the 20th century, you got the Pope as the self-appointed defender of human dignity against a secular world that he perceives as threatening it. Now, he's going to define dignity in a very biological way. I don't like the way he defines human dignity and human nature biologically. I just think that his science is bad. But he's got courage, and he's not quiet, and he's not going to be quiet. We don't have anything in Protestantism that even comes close to this, that even comes close to have duplicated the thinking process, let alone picked up the mace of courage, so to speak. I don't know what's going to happen, but if nothing else happens, I think you'll see the Vatican on the one hand becoming more and more isolated, but on the other hand becoming probably more and more daring with regard to the way it's going to treat these matters. Now, Zeit für Kinder, one of my overriding concerns, I shouldn't say overriding, one of my adjacent concerns just in general has to do with the place of children in the future of society. And it just appears, both in North America and around the world is becoming increasingly less safe for children. Children seem to be treated with and respect. And I took my genome project to Germany a couple of years ago to talk with German scientists, German theologians dealing with these issues. And the train stations were filled with posters like this. Children need more love than any house pet. So there's a kind of consciousness that we can't just take it for granted that children are going to be treasured and cherished. And one of my concerns with regard to the way that genetic research is going to impact society is through selling reproductive technology, selling genetic technology in baby production. And will there be some risk of commodifying children, some risk of seeing children as merchandise? I think there is a risk. And I think one of the tasks of the church and one of the tasks of ethically minded people is to somehow or other keep this on the front burner culturally so that we don't let our sense of dignity for children slip. Hence my slogan, God loves each of us regardless of our genetic makeup, we should do likewise. I'm going to skip over patenting. I could come back to it. Maybe I'll come back to that later because I would like to report on some very interesting frontier research in California right now. When I grow up, I'm going to be a scientist. I'll dedicate my career to the proposition that man can reshape the universe according to his own whims. I'll probably go into genetic engineering and create new life forms. You want to play God? Not exactly. God never bothered to patent his stuff. The patenting controversy just swirls around two issues. Number one, can we patent knowledge of the human DNA, those sequences of the nucleotides? The second question is, can we patent living creatures, such as the Harvard Onco mouse, which was created genetically? It's a unique new evolutionary development, but created by human scientists. Can new life forms be patented? Those are the two big issues. Well, let's talk about cloning. February 22nd of this year, Ian Wilmot at the Roslin Institute in Scotland announces that he has cloned the sheep that we now know of as Dolly. 7 days later, the write-up of his experiment appears for the first time in public in Science magazine. So for about 6 days before the Science becomes public, you have an international media event. And this international media event is centered around human cloning. Now, no human being was cloned, no research on human cloning was done. But because Dolly had come into the world, the whole world is astir over human cloning. Less than 24 hours after Wilmot's news conference, the Church of Scotland comes out with a statement saying, we Christians are opposed to cloning. And they argued that God loves diversity and cloning would eliminate or at least curtail diversity. Therefore, it is against God's will to clone human beings. They had another argument, that cloning would violate human individuality and human identity. and hence human dignity, therefore we ought not to clone human beings. So you got a secular argument, you got a theological argument having to do with God's will. But Church of Scotland wasn't the only one. You got religious people all over the world coming out against cloning. I mean, within 1 week, the Southern Baptist Convention had a statement against it. 2 weeks, the United Methodist Church had a statement against it. The Pope preached a sermon. Everybody thought the Pope was against it. He could have said anything. They would have thought he was against it. I think that as I didn't count noses exactly, but as I read newspaper articles and watched television, more theologians and ethicists were interviewed than scientists were interviewed. For me, given the kind of work that I'm in, I say, why does the world think that this scientific breakthrough is a religious issue? Why does it think? I don't know. But intrinsically, people saw it as a religious, it was a great source of humor, too, as you undoubtedly remember. But here's Time magazine. It's a great source of theology. If you had a chance, would you clone yourself? Look at that. 91% of people wouldn't. And they probably want to strangle the other seven. Is it against God's will to clone human beings? Well, the Church of Scotland thinks it knows God's will, and 74% of the people think that God would not want us to do that. Should the federal government regulate the cloning of animals? I don't see how that question fits with the other two, but they're for it. Maybe they're all Democrats. Who knows? Can souls be Xeroxed? I just love this. So the science, as it's interpreted in the media, is immediately religious in character, and a theologian doesn't even need to touch this. And it's just kind of dripping with religion. Well, March 4, I think it was, I can't remember for sure, Bill Clinton then holds a press conference. And he's going to do something about this. So less than 2 weeks now have transpired. The whole world is in an uproar. And Clinton calls on the National Bioethics Advisory Commission to study the matter. Now, the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, which they call NBAC, I don't know why they call it that. NBAC sounds so much better to me, but they call it NBAC. The NBAC had just been appointed, but they hadn't done a darn thing. The reason NBAC was called into existence was to deal with two issues. One, the gene patenting controversy, and secondly, to deal with experimenting on human subjects. But Clinton has already got these 15 experts in ethics, and so he announces that he's going to turn the cloning problem over to this panel. But in the process of giving his reason for it, he says, the problem with human cloning is that we would lose our identity and lose our individuality and our dignity would be threatened. And in the question and answer period, he said, we shouldn't play God with our genes. Now, if it comes from the president, I mean, that's going to be pretty good theology. Well, much to the credit of Washington, the NBAC went to work immediately, and in my judgment, they did a fine job. With only a three-month assignment, they interviewed the scientific community, they interviewed theologians. They had 2 days of live hearings in Washington, which they interviewed nothing but theologians. Catholics and Protestants and Jews and Muslims and philosophers. It just pounded that. I mean, you got all these people crying for separation of church and state, right? Or they're assuming that our government is secular. And they're assuming that in public policy debate, religion has no place. Baloney. It played a big role. Apart from the public hearings, they also had research going on. They had researchers running all over the country gathering data on what it is that people think about this whole thing. And all of that funneled into the report. I can't remember how long the report was, probably 150 pages, 8.5 by 11, something like that. One chapter on religion, one chapter on ethics, let alone getting to science and law and those kinds of things. Well, the report, gratefully, I think, dispelled what I think was religious hysteria on the question of human identity and human dignity. In my judgment, and in the judgment of NBAC, a cloned human being is not going to suffer loss of individuality or dignity or human rights. And some of the evidence that contributes to that judgment is that twins, identical twins, monozygotic twins, are a lot like clones. Monozygotic twins are born from the same egg. They have the same identical DNA. And when identical twins grow up, even if their mothers and fathers dress them alike and treat them alike and give them names that rhyme, they still develop their own interiorities, their own sense of identity, and their own individuality, and our society treats them as separate individuals with a separate, they have to have separate birth certificates and separate driver's license, etc. So the experience of monozygotic twins tells us that clones probably will not suffer. In addition to that, clones, if we ever have any, are going to be a little bit more different than twins are. Yes, they'll share the same DNA in the nucleus, but they'll have different mitochondrial DNA. In the case of identical twins, you've got the same egg from the mother with identical genomes. In the case of a cloned human being, you'll have the same DNA between the donor and the child growing up, but it'll be an egg from a different mother, different mitochondrial DNA. What we don't know is whether or not the mitochondrial DNA has some triggering effect on which genes get expressed or not. Don't know that. By the way, I need to back this up and give you why this is a scientific breakthrough. All the cloning prior to this date was really a form of twinning. That is to say, you would start with undifferentiated eggs, like embryos, and just cut them in half, and you have lots of twins. What was unique about the Rosalind Scotland experiment was they started with an already differentiated cell from the mammary gland of a 7-year-old sheep. They took this cell and they starved it of nutrients, which meant that the DNA kind of went to sleep. It became quiescent. Okay? So then they put this cell next to an oocyte, which is a mother's egg taken from another sheep, but the nucleus had been removed. So you got everything in the egg with the exception of the nucleus, and now you get this quiescent cell. They put them together, they hit it with a shock of electricity, and bang, the two of them merged. So now you have the quiescent DNA in the host egg. They hit it with a second charge of electricity, and that activated the DNA. And when it activated, and this is the genius of the experiment, when it activated, the DNA was pre-differentiated. What does that mean? Well, the cells that you and I as grown-ups have right now are differentiated. My fingernail cells have the same DNA as my brain. But the cells for producing fingernails are turned on and my brain cells are turned off. In my brain, my brain genes are turned on, I hope. And my fingernail genes are turned off. I've got to get my vocabulary right, okay? Now, the trick is to get the already differentiated cell to go back and start over as an embryo. That's what Ian Wilmot accomplished. That's what most scientists said would be impossible. That's the breakthrough. And we're waiting now for other laboratories to replicate it. Interesting side fact. Dolly was one sheep out of 277 that didn't work. There were 276 failures to get Dolly. Was it just luck? We'll have to just see as the experiment is repeated. Are we close to human cloning? No, we are miles away from human cloning. As far as I know, there are no experiments currently, but when the NBAC turned back its report, it said, number one, that your and my identity is not threatened if we get cloned. However, they recommend legislation against human cloning for the purpose of making babies, and here's their on what grounds?
Pardon?
Oh, no, they didn't even take up that issue. On the grounds that there are safety problems for the person being cloned. In addition, they wanted to say there are moral issues, and the religious community should be debating these moral issues. Well, I think they must have had lots of lawyers on the NBAC, because I think you can make a safety issue fly before a legislature, but it's hard to get religious opinions to work. So on the one hand, they really wanted to honor religious opinions, but on the other hand, they want the legislation to go through on the grounds that it's a safety problem. Now, what President Clinton finally did then was introduce into Congress a bill that says we will make it a crime to engage in human cloning for the purposes of making a baby for 5 years until the matter can be studied further. So it's got a sunset clause in it. So that's where we are. Now, in the meantime, other legislatures decided to take up the issue too. California, my home state, they had some bills proposed to outlaw cloning, and one lawyer argued that he wanted to make a secular, non-religious case as to why it is we should ban cloning. And his argument was, every human being has the right, by nature, to have a unique genome. Okay? He didn't like the Church of Scotland appealed that God likes diversity, okay? He said that every human being has a right to a unique genome. Now, I'm glad that that legislation didn't pass, because it would have outlawed all the identical twins, right? Now, which one do you put in jail? Or maybe both of them, it seems to me. But it seems to me that we've had 3 months or 4 months of hysteria over this. What I like about it is that people rightly saw that this is a religious issue and an ethical issue, not just a scientific issue. But on the other hand, there was a lot of, shall we say, bad information out there, and as far as I'm concerned, a lot of bad theology on the part of those who tried to climb on the bandwagon pretty quickly. Now, this is Der Spiegel, which in Germany is sort of like Time magazine in this country. Note, just intuitively, I think these national magazines are very important for understanding culture. Okay, we've got clones of Adolf Hitler, clones of Albert Einstein, clones of Claudia Schiffer's, right? And note, capital letters on the cover, Der Sündenfall, the fall into sin. Science causes the human race to plunge into sin.